Hello everyone, this is Robbie Campbell from Track Podcast, and we're bringing you part two of our interview with John Danahay. So I hope you enjoyed part one, and in part one we heard about John's introduction to a lifetime of running and his racing days in the 1980s. So in part two we move on to talk about his coaching career, not only at club level but also through his independent coaching group. And how he set this up and is currently running it, high performance runner. So I hope you enjoy, and talk to you all soon.
So this seems like a good opportunity to be talking about your coaching. And so in 2015, you were still team manager, coach for City of Stoke. And then you moved in, then you said you had a year away from.
Yeah, 2016, I basically had a dropout. I couldn't do it anymore. I tried to do too much. I think I was trying to still run a bit myself, and coach and team manage, and it was just too much. And I was also coming towards the end of my work life in terms of what I did, you know, with my outside running life. So altogether, it just... I blew a fuse, really, and I couldn't do anything, really, for about a year and had a complete year out. But there was a couple of runners who basically wouldn't let me go. I tried to sort of stop everything, but a couple of people said to me, no, John, you need to keep at it and, you know, keep advising us, at least, even if you don't do coaching, you know. And so they really kept me just... had that or by a thread in it, and then when I decided that I actually could do something with it, I thought the answer is for me to be independent, really, of all the club stuff, so I didn't have to get dragged into doing it. That's the problem, as you know, with athletics clubs, they are run by volunteers largely. Not enough people want to do the really important jobs. You know, team management and things like that are very stressful, difficult jobs, really. Let alone coaching as well. And also, of course, there's always conflict of interest in coaching and team management. You know, picking your runners for the team, yes or no, you know, that type of thing. I had to have that year out. I couldn't cope, really, with that pressure at that time, and when I came back, I thought that being independent offered me the best way back, you know, and so that's when I sort of really developed my high performance runner initiative or project, I suppose I see it as.
Because it's quite an unusual thing to have an independent. I'd say what you've created is quite an unusual project. You can kind of look on the internet and kind of look around for similar projects run by coaches, and they're very kind of difficult to find. How did you create that ethos behind high performance running?
Well, exactly. You say what tends to happen with coaching and people setting up businesses, I suppose, as coaching online. Is what I found when I was looking at it is that it tended to be about the coaching. So you would have people advertising themselves, promoting themselves as so-and-so running coach. It's all about running coach or some combination of that in the words that they use to describe themselves, the name of their business and so on. And my ethos was, no, it's really about the runner. So that's where the high performance runner came. And the fact that I thought that people have a lot more potential than they often realize if they get the right advice, you know, because I'd seen it so much myself. You know, I'd helped runners who in some cases I'd runners who come to me who were barely able to run and they'd gone on to be pretty effective athletes, you know, so I'd seen it and over the years people coming and going and help them through coaching. So I decided that the focus, I wanted to focus more on the athlete, i.e. high performance runner, rather than the coaching per se. That was the driver. So that's the reason that I came up with that sort of like the business focus.
So yes, yeah, so you're concentrating on the athlete rather than the kind of coaching aspects in a sense.
Yeah, I think I don't make a strong attempt to sell the coaching. I'm really selling the experience and the advice side. The coaching comes as a result. If I offer good advice, then people continue to ask me questions, continue to use me. So originally, when I started, I started on the basis of people paid me if they wanted to, you know, and they did. And as it happened, I have lots of people who continue to do that. And so I'm having to change really into more like a subscription type service, as you'd expect from a normal online coaching business. But it's been tough for me to do that because I operated for so many years as a volunteer. But that's the reality. This is my, I suppose this is my work now. But I still operate on the basis of there's no minimum contract. It's just 1 month at a time. Some people only need a couple of sessions, you know, a couple of a chat and some advice, an email or two, and they go on their merry way with the information that they need. Other people, like, you know, want the continuity over in terms of, particularly in terms of monitoring and tracking and keeping an eye on what they're doing and making sure that they're sticking to the plan that's been agreed. It, you know, it's a two-way process in terms of coaching, and some people value that. They want somebody at the other end that they can contact at a moment's notice and say, you know, I was thinking of doing this run this morning, but I've got a bit of a runny nose. What do you think? It's those kind of things that come up. You want somebody at the other end who just says to you, no, I don't think you should go for a run, save it for tomorrow. And that might be all it is. You know, it's not necessarily highfalutin fancy stuff with plans and technical coaching and kind of stuff. It's almost like a mentor advice service in some cases.
How does that differ from club coaching? So maybe when you coach the likes of even Alex Brecker and towards the end of your time at City of Stoke and runners of that calibre, how have you had to adapt, if you've had to adapt at all, to kind of go with the independent route?
Generally, actually, it's been pretty similar. The only difference then was I had much more group training. As a club coach, obviously, I did Tuesday nights, the typical things you would expect a club coach to do. So I had more group training. But in the case of somebody like Alex, he was away at university for most of the time that he was improving rapidly. So he was remote anyway most of the time. He was down in London studying when he made his biggest improvements. And so that was good practice for what I do now. But most of my athletes who I help now are relatively local. You know, most, not all of them, but the vast majority are within 30-mile radius of where I live. One of the things that is extremely important to me is that face-to-face contact. I like to do what I call run chats, trail run chats, which are they're my business meetings, I suppose. They're the equivalent of somebody having a meeting with a client. I actually go for a run with them and have a chat on the way round, and I'm monitoring things like, you know, how are they breathing when they're going up the hills? I'll have a chat to them for an hour. You know, those are my sort of measures, really, and input, and that two-way process. So that's a really important part of my high-performance runner coaching and advice service, really, is that one-to-one basis for what I do.
I will come back onto the coaching in a moment, but what because you were such a solid middle distance track runner, at what point did your love for the trails come in?
I've run on trails since I was a boy. I have slightly bowed legs, which means that I suffer from very sore feet. when I run, particularly on hard surfaces, or I did for many years. I suffered from very sore feet, so I tended to run on softer surfaces, or at least variable surfaces, all the time. And in the 1980s, the canals were trails. Nowadays, in many places they tended to tarmac them or put hard surfaces on the towpaths. But in those days, you could run for miles along the canals. They were grass and mud. Towpaths, they were trails. And I also used to train on the local trails, Trenton Park, Hanchurch Woods, trails that I still go on today. I used to go on those mainly because of my feet. I just couldn't run on the road for long periods. So I always had that background. And then in the 2000s, late 2000s, I started to get interest online in ultra trail running scene, UTMB, Ultra Trail Mont Blanc, Western States, in America, all these sort of tales of wonder, really. These runners doing 100 miles and other ultra races, and that just as a running nerd, that the stories and the reports from those were very interesting. I coached one of my first athletes, serious athletes, was a guy called Brian Cole. I mentioned him before, who's the physio. Brian, he worked in Stoke. He was a Royal Marine working at the recruitment office. And he asked for my help because he wanted to win ultra road races, 100K, 50K. He was already fairly good, but he just couldn't get the wins. It just wasn't happening. He was breaking down at the wrong time, not able to deliver the performances when he needed them. So I helped him. And so that got me into the ultra kind of side of things. Brian won the UK 100K championships in 2009, the Celtic Cup, they call it. The international, he ran in the world championships a couple of times, exceptional athlete. I'm sure if he had done ultra trails at that time, he would have been one of the best in the world. He really was a very strong off-road runner, but he decided he won the UK championships anyway. As a result of coaching him, a local lady called Tracy Dean came to me, and she was already she was rising fast at that time, but I helped her to win the UK Ultra Trail Championships and also run for Great Britain. She ran for Great Britain a couple of times at that time as well in the world trail Ultra Trail Championships. So I thought, well, I'm helping these people. I'll give it a go myself, and I'll start small. I'll start with a couple of trail marathons. I did the Montane Trail Series that was on at the time, Montane Trail 26 series, starting off with Grisdale. It was a tough struggle. After about 15 miles, I'd had it, and it was a walk. It was a walk of just about death to the finish, but I got round, and I was probably about 12th in the race or something like that. But you learn. And Tracy, obviously, we between us and her in particular, she got a lot of advice from other ultra trail runners, that helped me a lot. I couldn't have actually done them without her help. It was like the athlete helping the coach rather than the other way around, because it was new, as a specific discipline, it was new to me. But I got better at it very quickly, not surprisingly. If you apply the same principles as you would to a lesser distance or to 100K on the road, in terms of the planning and organisation and looking at what you needed to do in training, then I got better pretty quickly and learned from the experience. I was never going to be an international athlete or anything like that, because at the end of the day, I was in my early 50s. But it was enough to win one of them and come second in another. in series within a year, you know, at 52, you can't really ask for much more, because I was racing guys who were half my age and beating them. And as you know, with trail marathons, at least, you know, typically between 3,000 and 5,000 feet of climbing in those races. So places like Rivington, Howgills, big steep hills, quite tough races. So you had to learn how to deal with those and run them effectively. So that's how that came about, really. But I realised by about the time I was 53 and I'd done four or five, I won that one. I realised that I needed to really concentrate on the coaching. And then I had that year out that took me out altogether. So that disrupted that. So and I've not felt the need to go back into competitive running again since 2015. I decided that I'm better helping others.
Well, by almost ending it with a marathon victory, it's almost like it's scratched that itch, hasn't it? So it's quite a nice way for you to kind of move into the world of, you know, coaching full time and not feel like any regrets or that you're missing out on anything.
That's right. I didn't feel exactly right. I tried almost every event. I did the Peak Sky race, which was 30 odd miles, so I'd even done an ultra in there as well, and run, you know, very effectively at that. Even though I'm not really ideally suited to those races, I'm a bit light and I'm a bit sort of, I bounce along when I'm running. I am more like a middle distance runner than I am an ultra runner in terms of my stride pattern and the way that I run. So I wasn't ideally suited to those races, really. So I did well considering, I think.
It's difficult not to talk about what's going on in the world at the moment and with you as a coach. So I don't want to get too bogged down, because we're all a bit sick of talking about lockdown and coronavirus and how running's had to adapt. But I mean, you did some great things very early in the lockdown period, setting up races for your athletes and anybody else. And in fact, I'd probably say that you were kind of ahead of the game, really, in terms of setting up the challenges and you almost saw what was to come in the need for runners to have a kind of competitive edge. And then obviously that kind of led into more virtual races. How did you adapt your coaching during the lockdown period?
Yeah, exactly. You say right at the beginning, I thought that that was the thing that people were going to miss, was that competitive aspect. I was very clear that I didn't want to do races as such, that they were just challenges. I wanted to set challenges for people, but with a competitive component to them, because when you're trying to coach, I'll come back to this in a moment, because it is a sort of particular bugbear of mine over recent years, compared to myself in the 1980s and early 90s. When you're trying to coach, you need regular milestones, regular targets. Having something which is like 4, 5, 6 months ahead, or even a year ahead, is hard work. You've got to have things on the way that keep people interested and keep them, tell you where you are, really. I've seen it more and more in recent years, particularly with elite level performers. They can go 3, 4, 5 months between races, and then each race becomes an absolute nightmare from a mental point of view, because you've got to hope that you've done everything right in training and for it to work right on the day. And the gaps between racing, certainly for serious runners, have got bigger and bigger. And in the 1980s in particular, but also the early 90s, people really raced as frequently as they could. They were there to race. And training was along the way. Okay, you would have, you know, some goals, perhaps a bigger goal, you know, like London, running the London Marathon or something like that. But people would race a lot more frequent, particularly shorter races. So you didn't get, so you got that continuity. So it's something that I've always been quite keen on, is that people should race regularly. I think that it's a bit of training that is probably as important, more important than a lot of the other stuff. You've got to have that feeling of fear on the line and experience it regularly. If the gap gets too big and you've got like 3 months since your last race, you're almost like going in there for the first time, and you just forget, let alone all the skills and the actual race tuning, the effort that you put in that helps your fitness. Okay, it's different for a marathon or a longer race where you might need a long time to recover afterwards. But if you're racing 5K, 10K, 4 miles, 5 miles, those kind of distances regularly, and also track, shorter track races, you can squeeze plenty of those in. And all you do is you replace the training session. There is a tendency, it's definitely a tendency to think, well, a training session is better than the short race. And I think that's what we have lost that a bit, that people are getting divorced from that experience. And it gets harder. Every time you leave it a long time, it gets that much harder.
I think the great thing about your challenges is that, running a race isn't just about putting your body physically through it. The whole race day experience is, it's incredible, incredibly kind of individual in terms of the effects it has on your brain, in terms of your stomach, your legs, your sleep patterns and everything else. So I think having those kind of challenges to, not replicate it perfectly, but at least give you a flavour of it every now and again, is probably a great thing for your athletes, I'd say.
I hope so. As you say, I was very early on it because I realised that it would be the thing that they missed the most. And I think I was right. And as you say, a lot of people have followed. There's more challenges and races, virtual races now than you can shake a shoe at, as it were. It's like, it's people have, I mean, never mind. I mean, all mine were free and continue to be free because they were just challenges for my athletes. But now people have realised that you can make a fair amount of money out of people who are prepared to pay £25 for a £1 medal.
I'm not going to open that tin of worms because I had a bit.
It's the reality. And in actual fact, I can again be a bit disparaging, but in reality, I just want to see as many as people as possible run. I don't care how they do it. I don't care if that's their motivation. That's fine. Yeah. But I just want to see them run. I love to see people run, and participation is. The benefits of participation far outweigh any minor commercial activities that go on around it, I think.
And I think that's a great note to kind of end the bulk of the interview on. I think Ben's probably got a couple of questions he wants to jump in with you. What I would say is that, from my point of view, that comes through in everything that you do, in that mentality and that attitude to running. And I would say the thing that attracted me to kind of following you for a couple of years is that, when I first went on your website and your ethos is laid out and it's so kind of clear. It's almost quite unusual, really, to see it kind of defined so clearly that you've got no doubt as to, where you stand and, how you approach running. And I really think that's something that should be applauded. So, and just to kind of tie it in with the races as well, and like you said, the three virtual races. I think that's the fact that you weren't trying to, make a quick buck off people in difficult times, I think is to be applauded massively, because I'll probably share your views, like I said, I don't particularly want to open it now, but I think some of the races that you see advertised charging kind of £15-20 to make your own course around your local area is an interesting kind of business model, really. But
And it actually, behind the scenes, it has gone on for a good few years. There is a whole world of participation out there that maybe us as club runners haven't really been fully aware of. There's a whole range of things that sort of have running in them somewhere, color runs, all kinds of stuff that goes on. And I suppose it links into Park Run, which is obviously free, but there's a whole kind of level out there that perhaps maybe us as more traditional club runners have struggled to adapt to. But of course it offers loads, there are diamonds in the rough out there. There are people who are doing those things who are potential Olympic champions.
Yeah.
They are there somewhere. So it's important. I don't discourage those things, whatever the commercial interests are. It's got people running. There may be people on there who do want to be high performance.
Well, runners. I think if by chance any of them are out there listening to this, and they're kind of umming and ahhing about joining the club, then they could do worse than, you know, looking you up and kind of joining in with the high performance runner kind of mentality. It's a nice step into that world. I will come back to you just at the end. But Ben, have you got a couple of questions for John?
Yeah, thanks, John. That was really, really interesting. And just to echo Robbie's point, it's so nice to hear someone just so evidently passionate about running to just hear the stories and just sort of just hear your thoughts about where running was and where it is now. I guess my question sort of goes back to that point a little bit. You've mentioned a few times, particularly with cross country and your track races, the depth that did exist in perhaps the 80s particularly. And, you know, it could be argued that some of the very best are still as good as the very best were back then. But why do you think that depth now isn't there compared to the 80s? What's changed in the interim time, which means we have fewer runners at that top end or fewer runners that are running, times that would have been fairly normal back in the 80s?
Yeah, it is exactly as you say. It's not the best people. The best people are just as good as they ever were, if not better. It's below that. It's at the club level, really. I think particularly traditional track and field clubs are really struggling to get what's being lost is that continuity from being a boy or a girl and working your way up through the system. The system breaks, something like 50% now, or is it 18-year-olds, something like that. I don't quote me on the statistics, but I know it's a very high proportion now go to university, whereas in the early 80s, it was something like 15% or something like that. So what happened is that people are at a club as a youth, they go to university and everything changes, they go away from home in so many cases. And even if they go to Loughborough or Birmingham or a sports university, those are very small numbers in the scheme of things. But so basically the dropout rate is very, very high. And you don't see, when you go to running clubs, you don't see many young men and women in their 20s. There's just a big gap. They come back, in their 35, 40, have kids, family, are perhaps a bit older. They've gone through life and they come back 20 years after they last ran. And so there's that big gap. That gap used to be full of runners. That's what I'm saying. If they didn't go to university, they worked local. They stayed local. They stayed with the same coach. They stayed with the same club. They worked through the system and developed as runners, and also they went through, in many cases, they went through the traditional mill in terms of track in the summer, cross country in the winter, road relays, back onto track, going around that circle for a few years, and that was an extremely good development process for their speed and endurance, So they went through that. Whereas now, people who come into the sport later can potentially be very good athletes. They tend to come into a half marathon or a marathon as their start point. They're not going through that development process. And I think that's where the gap is. And so it's a numbers game. The people who carry on into their early 20s who, you know, who could fill those races with star performers. They're just less, there's just a lot less of them for that particular reason. You know? And not only the university, but generally life is different culturally. You know, lots of other social and cultural aspects to life, work and so on. It's probably say when I was at Polytechnic in the early 1980s, I don't think studying, I think it was anywhere near as intensive as people have to do at university now. I wouldn't for one moment say it's their fault. They're under a lot more pressure in terms of exams and studying generally. Most of these institutions now, they struggle to keep the running going. So you get to 21, 22, and there's hardly anybody. How many people do you have at your club who are 21, 22?
Yeah.
You know, and those were, in reality, when the depth in the fields, that's where the people were in the 20s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a really interesting one. I think there are so many runners now. You do see so many runners, but I think, as you said, it seems to be the fun runners and sort of the charity runners, that those are the perhaps the now running boom that's happening. But there is that gap, it appears, which is one of the reasons for this podcast, I suppose. We wanted to shine a light on that good club runner. But as you say, there just seems to be few of them around at the moment. But that's really interesting to hear your thoughts. So thank you for that. John, I am conscious of time and keeping you for too long. So what I think I'll do...
I'm all right, don't worry.
Happy,
yeah.
That's great. We have a couple of generic type questions that we like to ask, or we're hoping to ask all of our guests. And one of them is, do you have a running recommendation, either a good book you've read or a film you've seen, and it could be new or old or anything in between, or a piece of running media that you think our listeners would enjoy?
Specifically, that's a difficult one. I posted a picture the other day, Robbie probably saw it, of my library of running books.
Right.
That I've collected. Over the years, it's behind me somewhere. You can just about see it behind my head, and there's hundreds of them. So it's actually quite a difficult question for me because I've got so many. There is so much in terms of literature and so on. But certainly for about the last 7 or 8 years, I think if you're interested in trail running, mm-hmm. and so on, I've always been encouraged by the I Run Far website. I just think they have an ethos in terms of what they do, in terms of supporting races and the reporting, which I've enjoyed over the years, and the reports they do from races and trying to keep people up to date. It's, you know, the sort of online reporting as things happen has been very interesting to me. And particularly in terms of trail running, the some of the video, the YouTube type stuff, there was a couple of years ago, a very famous 50-mile duel of runners, American runners, where the cameraman is following them with the camera along the coast. I can't remember the exact details, but I watch it fairly frequently because it just gives. I think the future of that involvement of the camera and video with the racing is an important thing that running does need to bring into itself, including track and field, and almost on a local scale. It, you know, you have these meetings and you have races, but nobody beyond us knows about them or sees them, and because of that they don't get any kind of commercial linkage at all. It's all done by amateurs, and it feels to me in some cases it's like on a curve towards oblivion. You know, it's slowly being lost in the world. So I think people have got to be more creative about the way that they promote and they present those things. A bit along the lines of the way in which the Night of the 10,000 thing has been done, you know, down in London. I think that's that kind of thing. It changes the perspective of something that previously most people would have found very boring and lacking in any interest. And okay, maybe it still is of interest to us, but we're an important audience too. You know, so the sport itself is an important audience, and you've got to keep people engaged.
Perfect. Okay. All right, John, just before I hand you back to Robbie, and another thing we want to do is just answer or ask three sort of quick fire questions, perhaps a bit more fun, light-hearted questions at the end of the interview. So I've got three quick fire questions for you. Okay, the first one is, if you could go for a run with any athlete, doesn't necessarily have to be a runner, but if you could go for a run with any athlete, dead or alive, who would it be?
Emil Zatopek.
Okay, yeah. Is he a big influence on you, was he?
I think he's sort of like been there. I think it's the attitude to running, you know, basically run until you drop.
Yeah.
I just like that. I'm never able to do it really myself, but it appeals to me so much in terms of somebody else having that approach. Okay. To push themselves to the limit, and I just think from what I've read, just the whole kind of sort of like ethos he had in terms of human approach.
Is that one of your winter coaching techniques, running in army boots in the snow, is it, John?
Well, funnily enough, when I'm injured, I do actually trot along the trails in my walking boots. Because I think to myself, yeah, why not? You know, it does build a bit of strength. And in fact, there's a very famous runner from this area, a guy called Roy Fowler, from the 1960s in particular, who won the what was the equivalent of the World Cross Country Championships in those days, in the early 1960s. Very famous runner from this area, Staffordshire Moorlands. And he was well known for training in his boots, in his work boots. Up and down the hills in the Staffordshire Moorlands. So you know, it is something which is probably people love the fancy stuff now, don't they? In terms of supplemental training, weights and drills and gym and all the kind of things, and sometimes they forget about the basic resistance training, perhaps that people did in the past, and. One things, you know, whether it's Emil Zatopek or Roy Fowler, is it David Bedford? I think he was known as Bootsy, wasn't he? Because he
trained
for some sort of his cross country, and you couldn't get anybody who was stronger than David Bedford. So yeah.
Great. So am I right in thinking we've taken a swerve from the quick fire here? But am I right in thinking on one of your books is a famous book, Today We Die a Little? The Zatopek book.
That's right. That's one of my books. Yeah, I bought it last year. I think it's only been recently published, within the last couple of years. So, yeah, that is a recommendation. You asked for a recommendation, and that is worth a read. In fact, one that I do always come back to, and many people recommend it, is The Ghost Runner, as well. You've probably heard about that one. You know, about this guy who was banned from running amateur races because he won a small prize in a boxing contest, and he was a really strong, committed runner, ultra type runner, but you know, generally in the 1950s, in the 50s, early 60s, and that is always to return to more than once. Again, it's about the human element running. That's something that particularly appeals to me. In terms of what drives people to go out there in all weathers and for something which really, you know, still is the case, even if you're an elite performer, other than Mo Farah and one or two people, most people who are runners make nothing out of it, not compared to other sports people, you know, cyclists and you know, if you're a Tour de France cyclist or whatever, these people make vastly more money than pretty well all the athletes, the endurance runners in the world, you know, and so we do it for the love of it.
Okay. So quick fire question number two. I know your racing, or most of your racing, is probably behind you, but we want to ask our guests, if they were sort of just only had one race a year, they could only race once a year and had to be the same race each year, what race would you go for?
I still would love to do Ultra Trail Mont Blanc.
Okay.
It is still, you know, when I was doing the trail races 6 or 7 years ago now, 5 or 6 years ago, I just had that on the screen when it was on. I'd watch it for the 2 days really that it covers, that sort of festival of races, 2 or 3 days. I'd just watch every minute that I could online, and I'd be out and it'd be on my phone watching the updates and things like that. So I would love to be there at Chamonix and on the start line to that one each year. You know, never say never,
I think some of the scenery and some of the photos you see from that race are just absolutely stunning, aren't they?
Yeah, I think it's just the sheer number of people who give it a go, and as you say, I have been to Chamonix just for a visit and looked around, you know, at what it's like, and I've been to the French Alps obviously, I think I would love to have a go at something like that. But and I was tempted, like I say, 5 or 6 years ago, I was tempted to really try and do those kind of ultra events. You know, you get some success at a trail marathon and you think you're going to be the next Kilian Jornet, basically.
Okay. Yeah. So last one, John, this one's a bit of a silly one, but if you had a race this weekend and you're getting your kit ready, are you going to be wearing your short split shorts, or would you be wearing the new modern half tights that you see Kipchoge running around in?
Oh, shorts. Yeah. I'm still, yeah. And they'd be fairly short shorts. I'm a 1980s runner. None of this down to the knee business, but no. Short. Shorts, absolutely. The vest that we would usually get issued with, certainly many years ago, would probably been previously worn by the shot putter. So it'd be hanging off my shoulders at the very least. You know, that was the nature of it. That's what club athletics, certainly in the past, has been about.
Great. Perfect. Well, that's the quick fire questions done, John. So thank you very much for that. I'll just hand you back to Robbie for a final bit.
Yeah, that's. I think I'd bet my my entire worth on you choosing the short shorts there, John. I've been very disappointed if you'd have said the half tights. I'm surprised. So, just before I let you go, we will put the. I saw the video that you posted on Facebook. It was the Hayden Hawk, Zach Miller. One
that's shot. The one. Yes. Yeah.
And I remember seeing it because I always thought I was the only person that kind of watched that, and I always thought it was a bit of a sad affair that I'd kind of sit there and watch it for 20 minutes, just the clipping of the footsteps on the trail. And then you posted it saying it's one of your favourite videos. So we'll share it with our little social media audience, definitely, because it's a really great video. And if you don't want to go out and run a trail after watching it, then there's something wrong with you, really. So I mean, just to finish off, just by kind of giving you a plug, really, John. To be honest, I mean, you've got great presence on the internet and on social media, and I think that reflects your kind of outward and forward-looking approach to your coaching. So if people want to kind of hit you up and look into what you're all about, your high performance runner is www.highperformancerunner.com. Facebook, so you've got your Facebook for High Performance Runner as well.
At High Performance Runner will get you there, yes.
Yeah, so stick it in, yeah. Obviously Twitter and Instagram as well, and we'll put links to all of that in our on our social media presence, like I said, as well. And very finally as well, it's something I've been meaning to do for a long time, John, or since I saw them. I am going to buy one of your technical t-shirts off you.
Oh, thank you. hold fire for just a week or two, because I'm going to do, I've got some new ones that my daughter's a graphic designer.
Okay.
So the High Performance Runner branding and the website, actually all she has all done.
Okay.
She's done it. It's free. everything that you see is actually her in terms of the visual side. And so the t-shirts, we've actually got a couple of new ones that are just out. I'm just waiting for what they look like and for the samples to come back to me. Well, I'm happy with them. So please, yes.
Genuinely, she obviously must be talented, because the t-shirt is it's rare that I kind of want to part with my money on things like this. And
thank you very much.
It's a beautiful t-shirt. So you know, it kind of captures the kind of essence of what you do, and also that kind of classic look as well. So
thank you. She'll be pleased to know that. That's what. Yeah, she. That's what she's kept saying to me, is that the retro look is in, she said.
It's yeah. So make sure I want a medium anyway, John. So
okay, I'll make sure you get one. Okay. Thank you.
Look, it's been absolutely brilliant talking to you, and really appreciate you giving you time up on a Tuesday night for us. I know we've kept you a little bit longer. I think that we could, to be honest, I think we could talk and listen to you for a lot longer. So, so again, yeah, just a massive thank you.
Thanks for having me on.
And all the best, and take care, and keep doing what you're doing.
Thank you for listening to episode 2 of Track. We hope you enjoyed the interview with John Danahay. Join us again next week for episode 3, where we discuss the latest running news and events, and we interview Dr. Andy Renfrew.